There are daily raids on private homes and offices, and more than 3,740 people are currently in detention.
He's talking about what happened in Myanmar. This is Thursday, the 13th of May, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman. Also ahead, the India COVID variant is spreading quickly. Americans abroad have trouble finding COVID vaccine. More female journalists in Bangladesh are being harassed by fundamentalist groups. A U.S. prosecutor wants the death penalty for a man accused of killing 8 people, most of them women of Asian descent. It is all on today's VOA Asia. The United Nations Office of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights is calling on the international community to do more to stop the brutal crackdown by Myanmar's military authorities on civil society and prevent the further deterioration of human rights in the country. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Credible sources report at least 782 people have been killed since Myanmar's military authorities seized control of the country on February 1st and ousted its democratically elected leaders. The UN Office for the High Commissioner for Human Rights says the military shows no sign of easing its crackdown on opponents who remain defiant and continue to protest against the coup leaders. The High Commissioner's spokesman, Rupert Colville, says besides killing protesters, military authorities continue to commit other gross violations of human rights against Myanmar's people.
There are daily raids on private homes and offices, and more than 3,740 people are currently in detention. We are deeply alarmed at the whereabouts and fate of hundreds of these individuals are unknown, and these are situations that may amount to enforced disappearances.
Over the past month, Colville says the military has issued more than 1,500 arrest warrants targeting civil society activists, trade unionists, journalists, and academics, and public personalities. He says military authorities increasingly are taking family members of wanted people into custody to force them to turn themselves in to the police. He says the international community must put greater pressure on Myanmar's generals to abide by a 5-point plan they agreed to at a meeting of the regional bloc ASEAN on April 24th. The plan includes a call for an immediate cessation of violence and for a constructive dialogue among all parties to look for a peaceful solution. Colville says the military leadership is taking no steps to make this happen.
As a result, as we're seeing a continuation of the violence, a continuation of arbitrary detention and arrests, people starting to flee the country, and as you say, the economy and the whole structure of society being really badly damaged when you lose your teachers, your university professors, your civil servants, your journalists, you start to have a really crumbling social structure.
The UN Human Rights Office is calling on ASEAN to react quickly and to intensify efforts to make the military keep its commitments. It adds the 10 Southeast Asian countries that form this bloc should hold Myanmar's leaders accountable for failing to do so. The military has justified its takeover of the country by claiming without evidence that the 2020 general election won by the ruling National League for Democracy was riddled with fraud. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
These are among the top Asia headlines you'll find right now on voanews.com. China pushes back over scrutiny of Uyghur rights at a UN event. Taiwan may raise its COVID-19 alert level amid reports of a record 16 new domestic cases. U.S. military coy about numbers of troops leaving Afghanistan. The U.S. track and field team cancels its pre-Olympics training camp in Japan out of concerns for safety amid COVID-19. The WHO reviews Vietnam's proposal to produce mRNA COVID-19 vaccines. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on Facebook at VOA Asia, Instagram, Twitter, and on the voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. A day after declaring the coronavirus variant first detected in India as one of global concern, the World Health Organization announced Wednesday that the variant has spread to 49 countries. The UN Health Agency's new concern about the variant comes as India recorded over 4,000 deaths, a new one-day record that pushed the South Asian nation's overall toll from the pandemic past the 250,000 mark. A surge of new infections in the world's second most populous country has created a humanitarian disaster there, with hospitals filled to capacity and an acute shortage of oxygen to treat the sick, and scores of makeshift crematories burning the dead. Experts believe the actual casualty figures are much higher than the official ones. The situation took an unsettling turn this week after more than 100 bodies were found floating in the Ganges River. The images sparked anger and speculation that the people who died succumbed to COVID-19. Authorities have yet to determine the cause of death, but some medical experts have voiced concern that the coronavirus can be spread through contaminated water. Reuters' Matthew LaRotunda has more.
India's coronavirus death toll passed 250,000 people on Wednesday, in the worst 24 hours since the pandemic began, continuing to break national records and with no certainty over when it may peak. Around 4,000 deaths are being registered each day in India, although many experts say the actual toll could be 5 to 10 times higher. There are so many dead that with cremation centers remaining overwhelmed, resorting to burning in parking lots. Scores of bodies are also being found washed ashore in the river Ganges. The bodies have been put in the river by family members after some towns ran out of wood to keep the cremations going. Part of the reason why experts believe the toll is so much higher than the official count is because so many are dying without a doctor on hand to register a death certificate. Even when a doctor is available, COVID isn't listed as the cause of death unless the person was previously tested, and most are not. Lack of supplies continues to worsen the situation. The virus is also spreading rapidly into rural areas, which don't have the hospital infrastructure of the big cities. This man, who brought a loved one to a rural clinic, told us no doctor has been visiting them, no one has told them what medicine to administer, and no one would bring precious oxygen. They eventually had to go get it themselves. A women's college in Kerala has converted itself into what it calls an oxygen war room, staffed by volunteers to safeguard the supplies and do what they can.
That was Matthew LaRotunda reporting. The situation in India is one reason the International Federation of the Red Cross says coronavirus cases have exploded across Asia over the past 2 weeks. More on that from correspondent Charles de Ledesma.
The International Federation of the Red Cross says coronavirus cases have exploded in Asia with over 5.9 million new infections. The Red Cross says more people have been diagnosed with the disease in Asia over the past 2 weeks than in the Americas, Europe and Africa combined. The group warns the surge is pushing hospitals and health systems to the brink of collapse. 7 out of the 10 nations doubling their infection numbers fastest are in Asia and the Pacific. Campaigners are calling for more regional support with shipments of medical equipment, support for prevention and urgent access to vaccines. Vaccination campaigns in Asia are hampered by shortages, hesitancy, and the costly logistics of reaching many areas. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
Still ahead on VOA Asia, American expats say they need COVID protection. Stay with us. Happening now in Asia, the Philippines on Wednesday reported what it said were incursions into its exclusive economic zone by 287 maritime militia vessels from China, a further sign of cracks reappearing in a relationship after a period of rapprochement. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. Thank you for being with us here on VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman. Americans abroad are increasingly asking Washington to send surplus coronavirus vaccines to overseas embassies for U.S. citizens in far-flung countries where the pace of inoculations is much slower or access to vaccines is limited. The U.S. vaccination drive covers more than its total population, and surplus doses were earmarked for donation to India and other nations. Overseas citizens argue that the estimated 8 million Americans living abroad should have the same right to vaccine access as citizens back home. Peter Fishbach has lived in Thailand for nearly 30 years.
We have addressed a letter to Secretary of State Blinken, specifically asking that State Department, which knows where Americans live and what Americans need, that they facilitate bringing vaccines from the U.S. to places where Americans can reasonably access those vaccines.
Fishback worries it may be weeks or months before he can be vaccinated in Thailand, and his business obligations, plus Thailand's strict two-week quarantine for people entering the country, make it unfeasible for he and his wife to travel to the U.S. to be vaccinated.
I own a small business here, so for me to just go away for 2 months, okay, I can do a lot of work remotely, but it's still a significant chunk of time, and I'm not a wealthy individual. I mean, it's still a significant amount of cost if I and my wife were to go to the States and then take that amount of time and then come back here. So it's not something that it's a decision that I at some point may have to make, but I think it would make much more sense for the U.S. to get vaccines to Americans overseas.
The advocacy group American Citizens Abroad wrote to the U.S. Congress and the State Department in April saying that taxpaying overseas Americans should have access to vaccines as residents of the United States have. In Thailand, four U.S. citizen groups on May 6th sent a joint proposal to U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken asking for the Southeast Asian country to be made a pilot project for global vaccination of Americans abroad. The U.S. Embassy in Bangkok declined to comment on the request. Thailand is in the midst of a deadly third wave of coronavirus after a year of successfully containing it, and its mass vaccination drive is not expected to begin until next month. Washington has already shipped vaccine doses to embassies worldwide to vaccinate its own diplomats. The chairperson of Democrats Abroad Thailand, Paul Risley, is disappointed.
The response we've gotten so far has simply been to a press query from a journalist where they said that they will not provide medical services for private citizens.
Risley was referring to a White House briefing this week when Press Secretary Jen Psaki said the U.S. government is focused on the safety of Americans around the world but was not prepared to provide vaccines at the moment.
VOA Asia is on Twitter. Follow us at VOA Asia for developing stories in Asia, perhaps close to you. Our Twitter feed also has updates on programs you can hear and see, with links to easily find them. VOA Asia Twitter, we're always online for you.
This news from VOA Asia. The head of the main Indian health agency responding to the coronavirus has said districts reporting a high number of infections should remain locked down for another 6 to 8 weeks to control the spread of the rampaging disease. All of the big stories come your way through the day on VOA Asia Twitter and Facebook. This is VOA Asia. We continue on VOA Asia. Bangladesh is seeing a rise in the number of female journalists being harassed by fundamentalist groups, raising security concerns for reporters out on assignment. VOA's Sanjana Feroz has more.
Mobs surrounding and harassing media during protests by fundamentalist or Islamist groups. Bangladesh is seeing more incidents like this, prompting female journalists and their news managers to rethink personal safety and the risk of covering some stories. Earlier this year, members of the Hifazat-e-Islam Islamist group attacked Ghazi TV's Rubina Yasmin during protests against a visit by Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi.
Some activists came to me and asked why I was dressed in men's clothes. I did not want to engage in any argument at that moment, fearing for my life, even though I was wearing a bulletproof vest. They complained that I was not wearing a veil.
It is becoming difficult for women journalists in Bangladesh to survive, says Nadia Sherman, a crime reporter for Channel 71.
Women journalists are usually seen as not so important. Very few media outlets in Bangladesh have moved away from that notion. Many media officials are proud to say that their organization does not hire women.
Female journalists are doing good work, and dedication, professionalism are driving them forward, says Shakil Ahmed, head of news for Channel 71. But Ahmed says he worries about the risk of attack out in the field.
I have to think multiple times before signing a woman on a risky assignment. Even 5 years back, they could easily cover these kinds of assignments, but now the scenario has changed a lot. My worry is the lifelong impact a mob attack could have on a female reporter.
The risk factor in assigning a female journalist to some stories is impacting the fight for equality, says journalist Ishrat Jahan Urmi.
When women are being physically attacked and have life-threatening injuries, how can one fight for equal rights? I think these incidents are instigating women to stop fighting for their rights.
Despite the challenges, women journalists in Bangladesh say they will keep working to win their fight for equality. Sanjana Feroz, VOA News, Washington.
The United States improved from 48th to 44th last year in the Reporters Without Borders 2020 Press Freedom Ranking, but violent incidents committed by both authorities and civilians against journalists prompted law enforcement to team up with a nonprofit to de-escalate tensions before tempers run over. VOA's Arash Arabasadi has more on that.
For journalists in Washington, the year started with the storming of the United States Capitol in January. Then a pro-Trump mob tore down barricades and attacked journalists in their gear. That violence against journalists followed a summer in which millions protested the police killing of George Floyd, and police clashed sometimes violently with protesters and press. So Georgia law enforcement officials and the Georgia chapter of the Society of Professional Journalists, or SPJ, saw the opportunity for a teaching moment.
What we have here is a protest situation where police are needing to defuse the protesters. They're entering an area where they shouldn't, or things are starting to get violent and they need to. It's no longer peaceful.
I'm here live on the scene of a protest.
Former president of the Georgia SPJ, Charlotte Norsworth, appears in this training video as a reporter before a mock crowd of protesters hostile toward police. The course at the Georgia Public Safety Training Center guides law enforcement to de-escalation instead of conflict, but it also teaches journalists to respect legal boundaries. Chad Wilson is division director for basic training. He says the program helps bridge the divide between law enforcement and media.
You really get to see that it's, you know, it's not just a person with a microphone in your face, or it's not just a person with a camera. From our perspective, you know, they're human beings just like we are. And then from the media perspective, I think it's also important that they got to see that, you know, there's a human being standing behind that shield wearing that helmet. And at the end of the day, we all want to just do our job.
Both Norsworth and Wilson agree there is growing mistrust between journalists and law enforcement as police have increasingly become the subject of protest. Still, both are quick to call this training a well-received step in the right direction.
Well, I think so far it's been way more successful than we thought it was going to be to start with.
Police and journalists have rights that start and end at very specific time frames. And it is a two-way street that requires participation and respect from both police and the press. It won't work without that.
If we get nothing other than just open lines of communication out of this, I think we've done more than a lot of people have ever gotten done.
Justice! Wilson says the training also exposes officers from more rural areas to media presence they would typically not encounter. The physical program is new, but online training modules are available to all Georgia law enforcement. Arash Arabisadi, VOA News.
Making headlines in Asia, a new law that tightens patriotic loyalty tests for Hong Kong politicians will take effect later this month after being passed by the city's legislature on Wednesday. The law is widely expected to further stifle Democratic opposition in the global financial hub. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, a U.S. prosecutor plans to seek the death penalty for a man accused of killing 8 people, most of them women of Asian descent, in shootings at 3 Atlanta-area massage businesses amidst a rash of attacks on Asians in the United States. The Fulton County, Georgia prosecutor announced the decision Tuesday after 2 grand juries indicted 22-year-old Robert Aaron Long on murder charges.
A 19-count indictment against Robert Aaron Long.
Fannie Willis, the Fulton County DA, said she was seeking the death penalty.
We have filed a notice that we will seek sentence enhancement pursuant to Georgia's sentencing enhancement statute, commonly referred to as a hate crime statute, based on the race and gender of the victims.
That was Fulton County District Attorney Fannie Willis. The incident only covers the 4 killings that happened at 2 spas in Atlanta. A separate grand jury in suburban Cherokee County will decide on charges in the shooting at a spa there in which 4 were killed and 1 person was wounded. We continue on VOA Asia. Russia denies involvement in the cyber attack that crippled Colonial Pipeline, a critical artery for almost half of the U.S. East Coast's fuel supply. Meanwhile, drivers are beginning to see shortages and surging prices at the pump. White House correspondent Patsy Whitaker-Suera has this report.
As officials sought to soothe concerns about fuel supply, some Americans are already paying more at the pump.
It's just one more thing that takes us into major stress.
Colonial Pipeline, which delivers almost half the petroleum fuel consumed on the U.S. East Coast, stopped operations last week due to a ransomware attack. These are cyber attacks where malicious actors seeking a financial payout hold hostage companies and government's networks, paralyzing their service. The FBI says DarkSide, a criminal group based in Russia or Eastern Europe, is responsible. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki.
We'll wait for our intelligence community to make a full assessment before we have more to convey about it.
DarkSide said it only wants to make money and has no interest in geopolitics. On Tuesday, Russian government spokesperson Dmitry Peskov denied involvement.
We strongly object to any accusations against us in relation to this.
In April, the Biden administration slapped sanctions on Russia for involvement in the SolarWinds cyber attack targeting federal agencies. Cyber experts say an international accord, preferably one including Russia, is needed to halt ransomware attacks. Meg King is director of the Science and Technology Innovation Program at the Wilson Center.
Unless we can find a way to stop the business model, to make it harder for these criminal groups based in Russia and surrounding regions to hack and get companies to pay to release their data, unless we can help companies to have data backups, unless we can help critical infrastructure operators understand what their risks are, then this problem will continue.
Colonial Pipeline said it's working to restore services. Meanwhile, the Biden administration has taken steps to address fuel shortages, including temporarily allowing lower quality gasoline blends to boost supply and enlisting rail operators to transport fuels to areas that need it most. Secretary of Energy Jennifer Granholm.
It's not that we have a gasoline shortage. It's that we have this supply crunch and that things will be back to normal soon.
If needed, the administration is also preparing to waive a federal rule that requires fuel shipped between U.S. ports to be transported on ships built, owned, and operated by Americans. Patsy Whitaker-Suera, VOA News.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. Like us on Facebook, VOA Asia. Follow us on Twitter at VOA Asia. And find us on Instagram and YouTube and at voanews.com. Thanks for joining us. Thanks to our service chief, Diane Gao. Our VOA Asia team includes Doug Bernard, Keith Lane, Amy Heibels, and Jim Stevenson. I'm Ira Melman. Enjoy the day ahead and stay safe.